infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
The power of a new generation.
Greetings, and you're listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. Let's have some tunes to start this one off. How about a few brief overviews of Earth and environment reports? Summer downer for Norway cod to start off with. Now, as climate changes, the Skagerrak coast of southeastern Norway may turn unfriendly to the commercially important Atlantic cod fishery, warns a Norwegian-U.S. research collaboration. The researchers say warmer springs may rev up growth among cod not even a year old, but warmer summers appear to stunt growth and should be increasingly likely to wipe out spring benefits. This push-crush dynamic, described January 18th in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, contrasts with earlier results suggesting that warm summers boost growth. The new analysis was made possible by an unusual series of cod surveys performed annually from 1919 through 2009. Smoke on the water? Fallout from burning coal may have choked the life out of 90% of marine species some 250 million years ago, Canadian researchers argue in the January 23rd Nature Geoscience. Huge quantities of carbon-rich char fell on the high Arctic prior to the Permian mass extinction of marine organisms, the scientists found. Based on the carbon's geology and chemistry, the researchers propose that it traces back to the natural combustion of Siberian coal and organic-rich sediments. Being remarkably similar, quote-unquote, to modern coal fly ash, the char would have been toxic to aquatic life and ultimately would have dispersed globally, the researchers say. You can look that up in Nature Geoscience, January 3rd, if you want to read more. Picking out on licorice. This is very interesting. Most U.S. livestock farms administer low doses of antibiotics to ward off infections that might limit their animals' growth. Japanese scientists report preliminary data online December 22nd in the Animal Science Journal. You might have missed it, but here it is. It indicates that certain natural products, such as licorice and seaweed, enhance the immune systems of pigs. It's possible, they conclude, that including such products in animal feed could limit the overuse of antibiotics in agriculture, a practice that has been charged with fostering the development of resistant microbes that can later infect people. Very interesting. December 22nd in Animal Science Journal, if you want to read more about that, and I'm sure you will. A weaker carbon pump. Oceans are a key player in the planet's carbon cycle, but researchers may have found that one way the oceans store carbon is less significant than thought. A team led by researchers from the National Oceanography Center in Southampton, England, report in an upcoming issue of Geophysical Research Letters on new measurements of the, quote, biological carbon pump, unquote, which sequesters small carbon-rich particles that sink from the ocean surface to its depths, using a version of the radioactive element thorium, which sticks to particles and thus traces their movement. The researchers found that much less carbon was sinking than other indirect studies have suggested. Very interesting. Look for that in Geophysical Research Letters. When that story comes out, I'll bring you more details. Greenland's big melt. Well, of course, this is something that everybody's watching. Greenland's massive ice sheet may be melting in a more complex fashion than scientists had realized. It's known that meltwater atop the ice percolates down and lubricates glaciers advance, thus hastening ice loss into the ocean. But a team led by scientists at the University of Leeds in England suggest in the January 27th Nature that this is not the whole story. Their studies of six glaciers in western Greenland show that drainage at the glacier's bottoms becomes more efficient as the summer advances, helping offset melt-induced ice acceleration. The work could improve predictions on how sea levels rise to expect as Greenland thaws. We'll check that out and we'll give a little bit more because there are an awful lot of people looking at this and an awful lot more commentary about that January 27th issue of Nature Report. Have you ever thought there are things that you could do better asleep than awake? Well, guess what? You were right. Things you can do better asleep than you can awake. Is this next report? And as you sink into sleep, you enter a state called hypnagogia, similar to hypnosis. You may hear strange noises or snatches of imaginary conversations, experience odd physical sensations, and see vivid hallucinations of geometric shapes. Your muscles may twitch involuntarily. Nobody's sure why, nor does anyone know why. As we enter deeper sleep, our white blood cell count rises and eventually we begin to dream. But after decades of careful observation, scientists have figured out that there are a few things we do better when we're sleeping than when we're awake. The first one, forming accurate memories. Most neuroscientists agree that sleep is when we organize memories for long-term storage. People whose sleep is disturbed after studying have far more imperfect recall than people who get a good 8 hours of shut-eye. But a study published a couple weeks ago shows that you can use simple memory reinforcement techniques while you're sleeping that will make your recall better than average. Ooh, get a jump on the competition with this. A group of researchers gave a group of student volunteers a simple recollection test. Now, they had to match pairs of cards, take a nap, and then try to remember all the cards that they had matched up. But some of the volunteers were given this memorization task in an environment with a slight odor. Yes, a slight odor, that's what I said. While those volunteers took a nap, the smell was pumped into the place where they slept. The idea was to reinforce their memories with a smell associated with the task they'd done. Now, everybody that has read up on memory recall knows that smell is one of your most potent and longest lasting memories. So this is very interesting, and it worked. The people who slept with the smell performed significantly better than the control group after their nap. In fact, researchers say their recall was nearly perfect. But this doesn't mean that you should study while sniffing perfume, although you're welcome to try. It does show, however, that what our brains do while we're asleep has a lot to do with how well we remember what we've done while we're awake. Oh, healing from infection. Here's another interesting aspect. We don't just need sleep to improve our minds. We need it to heal our bodies. Somebody ought to tell everybody who works in a hospital, because that's the one place where you're supposed to be getting better, but you actually get no sleep or rest in there. You go home to get better. Physiologist Mark Opp argues that it's possible that sleep is part of our immune system, and that we may have evolved sleep alongside our other bodily defenses against infection. In fact, our ability to dream appears to be connected at a molecular level to our healing abilities. When researchers reduce the levels of proteins used in healing wounds and fighting infection, it also reduces REM sleep. Raising the levels of those same proteins causes people to dream more. So when you go to bed with a cold and wake up feeling better after a night of weird dreams, well, there's a good reason for that. Plus, our white cell count in our blood increases while we're asleep. Now, we can actually defeat parasites in our bodies while we snooze, believe it or not. Opp writes, quote, "Analysis of sleep time of 12 mammalian species, for which data are also available with respect to parasitic load, indicates that a 10-hour increase in sleep time is associated with a 24-fold decrease in parasitism," unquote. Well, that's pretty incredible decrease going on right there. The tragic corollary to all this is that the lack of sleep makes you more prone to infection. Mice who were sleep deprived started developing sores on their paws and tails. Humans who are sleep deprived are probably more susceptible to infection too. Derived from this. Now, dealing with stress, dreaming also appears to be one of the main ways we maintain emotional equilibrium. Sleeping appears to organize our emotions in the same way it organizes and solidifies memories. Researchers report that sleep helps people recognize other people's emotional states, maintain calm in the face of difficult situations, and even develop feelings of trust more easily. In a recent article from Sleep Medicine Reviews, two Belgian researchers echo many other neuroscientists in their field when they write that REM sleep in the dream state seems crucial to restoring emotional well-being. We handle stress better after undergoing certain brain activities that only dreams can unleash. They write, quote, "Sleep seems restorative in daily functioning, whereas deprivation of sleep makes us more sensitive to emotional and stressful stimuli and events in particular. The way sleep impacts next day mood emotion is thought to be affected particularly via REM sleep, where we observe a hyperlimbic and hypoactive dorsolateral prefrontal functioning in combination with normal functioning in the medial prefrontal cortex, probably adaptive coping with the continuous stream of emotional events that we experience," unquote. Now, you're not just handling stress better because you've rested. In fact, it's because dreams make your brain so active at night that you're able to tackle problems better after a good night's sleep. Now, this might lead you into wondering why exactly do we sleep? Now, while we can more or less abstain from some basic biological urges for food, drink, and, well, you know, relations, if you know what I'm talking about, we can't do the same for sleep. At some point, no matter how much espresso we drink, we just crash. Now, every animal that's been studied, from the fruit fly to the frog, also exhibits some sort of sleep-like behavior. Yes, all. Paul Sternberg, Morgan Professor of Biology, is one of the first to show that even a millimeter-long worm called a nematode falls into some sort of somnolent state. But why do we, the rest of the animal kingdom, sleep in the first place? Now, of course, we did talk a little bit about this in the last segment. Let's get more into depth. Now, we spend so much of our time sleeping that it must be doing something important, as we just talked about. And this, coming from David Prober, assistant professor of biology and an expert on how genes and neurons regulate sleep. Yes, we snooze in order to rest and recuperate, like we talked about, but what that means at the molecular, genetic, or even the cellular level remains a mystery. Saying that we sleep because we're tired is like saying we eat because we're hungry, Prober says. Duh. Now, that doesn't explain why. It's better to eat some foods rather than others, and what those different kinds of foods do for us. Now, no one knows exactly why we slumber, Prober says, but there are four main hypotheses. The first is that sleeping allows the body to repair cells damaged by metabolic byproducts called free radicals. Ooh, more information on that, because we just talked about healing yourself. The production of these highly reactive substances increases during the day when metabolism is faster. Indeed, scientists have found that the expression of genes involved in fixing cells get kicked up a notch during sleep. Wow, now that shines a little bit more information onto the situation. This hypothesis is consistent with the fact that smaller animals, which tend to have higher metabolic rates and therefore reduce more free radicals, tend to sleep more. For example, some mice sleep 20 hours a day, while giraffes and elephants only need 2 to 3 hour power naps. Now, another idea is that sleep helps replenish fuel, which is burned while awake. One possible fuel is ATP, the all-purpose energy-carrying molecule, which creates an end product called adenosine when burned. Now, when ATP is slow and adenosine is high, it tells the body that it's time to sleep. Well, a postdoc at Harvard, Prober helped lead some experiments in which zebrafish were given drugs that prevented adenosine from latching onto receptor molecules, causing the fish to sleep less. But when given the drugs that had the opposite effect, they slept more. He has since expanded on these studies at Caltech. Now, like we talked about before, sleep might be also a time for your brain to do a little bit of housekeeping. As you learn and absorb information throughout the day, you're constantly generating new synapses, the junctions between your neurons through which your brain signals travel. But your skull has limited space, so bedtime might be when superfluous synapses are cleaned out. And finally, during your daily slumber, your brain might be replaying the events of the day, reinforcing memory and learning. Thanos Siapas, Associate Professor of Computation and Neural Systems, is one of several scientists who have done experiments that suggest this explanation for sleep. He and his colleagues looked at the brain activity of rats while the rodents ran through a maze and then again while they slept. The patterns were similar, suggesting the rats were reliving their day while they sleep. Kind of like doggy dreams. They have little rodent dreams. Of course, the real reason for sleep could be any combination of these four ideas, Prober says, David Prober that we were talking about before. Now, perhaps only one of these hypotheses might have been true in our evolutionary past or other evolutionary past of other organisms, but as they evolved and we evolved, developed additional uses for sleep. Researchers in Prober's lab look for the genetic and neural systems that affect zebrafish, for example, and their sleeping patterns by tweaking their genes and watching them doze off. An overhead camera records hundreds of tiny zebrafish larvae as they swim in an array of shallow square dishes. The computer automatically determines whether the fish are awake or not based on whether they're moving or still and whether they respond to various stimuli. Prober has identified about 500 drugs that affect their sleeping patterns, and now his lab is searching for the relevant genetic pathways. By studying the fish, researchers hope to better understand sleep in more complex organisms like humans. Even if we find only a few genes that will really open up the field, he says, the future is promising, he adds, and for that, it will be well worth staying awake. And all this information was provided by the California Institute of Technology. And here's a little music break so that you don't fall asleep during the next report.
What I got, you gotta get it, but it is.
Okay, so you've gotten all that sleep and you're ready to go. What are you going to do with your brain? Guess what? You can do aerobic exercise, which can increase your brain size and keep you mentally sharp. Oh, yes. Another reason to follow through with that New Year's resolution, aerobic exercise keeps the aging brain as well as the aging body in fighting form. Researchers at the University of Pittsburgh, the University of Illinois, Rice University, and Ohio State showed that a program of aerobic exercise over the course of a year can increase the size of the hippocampus, which is the part of the brain key to memory and spatial navigation in adults ages 55 to 80. The hippocampus is known to shrink in late adulthood, leading to memory impairment. The results were made public Monday by the Journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. They back up earlier research that has shown a correlation between fitness level and brain function. To complete the study, the team recruited 120 older people who didn't exercise regularly. Now, when I say older people, they're older than me, so they're older. Sorry, don't know how else to put that. They were randomly assigned to an aerobic exercise program, walking around a track 3 days a week for 40 minutes per session. The other half embarked on a stretching and weights program. Both groups were carefully coached and monitored. They provided blood samples, performed spatial memory exercises, and were given MRIs at the beginning, halfway point, and the end of the research period. The group doing aerobic exercise had increases in hippocampus volume up 2.12% on the left hippocampus and 1.97% in the right hippocampus. The stretching group, on the other hand, had decreased hippocampus volume down 1.4% on the left and 1.43% on the right. Now, the participants also performed spatial memory exercises. Again, the aerobic exercise group had better function at the end of the year exercise. Blood tests also showed an increase in the levels of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, a chemical increased with learning and memory among the walkers. Increases in hippocampal size were associated with increased amounts of brain-derived neurotrophic factor. We demonstrate that loss of hippocampal volume in late adulthood is not inevitable, but it can be reversed with moderate intensity exercise, the team wrote, suggesting that a few laps around the track might be a particularly cost-effective way to treat a widespread health problem without the side effects of medication. And, researchers said, it's never too late. Starting an exercise regimen later in life is not futile for either enhancing cognition or augmenting brain volume, the team wrote. I know an awful lot of people that might not be able to ambulate around track like that, and guess what? They do Tai Chi. Tai Chi is classes. You can find them everywhere at the YMCA, at all sorts of great community centers, or you can actually get a DVD and do it in the comfort of your own home, and you don't have to do your hair before you walk out the door. So basically, whatever you do, get that heart pumping, because it will help your brain stay mentally agile and it will help you with your spatial navigation. Woohoo! And speaking of moving, let's move this right out into space. NASA finds Earth-sized planet candidates in habitable zone, six-planet system. NASA's Kepler mission, again, has discovered its first Earth-sized planet candidates and its first candidates in the habitable zone. Now, we talked about this before, but it's a little bit more information. A region where liquid water could exist on a planet's surface. Oh, yeah. Five of the potential planets are near Earth-size and orbit in the habitable zone of smaller, cooler stars than our sun. Candidates require follow-up observations, of course, to verify that they're actual planets, but Kepler also found six confirmed planets orbiting a sun-like star, Kepler-11. Now, this is the largest group of transiting planets orbiting a single star yet discovered outside our solar system. In one generation, we have gone from extraterrestrial planets being a mainstay of science fiction to the present, where Kepler has helped turn science fiction into today's reality, said NASA Administrator Charles Bolden. These discoveries underscore the importance of NASA's science missions, which consistently increase understanding of our place in the cosmos. The discoveries are part of several hundred new planet candidates identified in the new Kepler Polar Mission science data released on Tuesday, February 1st, the findings increased the number of planet candidates identified by Kepler to date to 1,235. Of these, 68 are approximately Earth size, 288 are super Earth size, 662 are Neptune size, and 165 are the size of Jupiter. And again, 19 are larger than Jupiter. I think that they already knew that before. Of the 54 new planet candidates found in the habitable zone, 5 are near Earth-sized. The remaining 49 habitable zone candidates range from super Earth size up to twice the size of Earth to larger than Jupiter, like we just said. The findings are based on the results of observations conducted May 12th to September 17th, 2009, of more than 156,000 stars in Kepler's field of view, which covers approximately 1/400th of the sky. Yes, 1/400th of the sky. I think I said that correctly. The fact that we found so many planet candidates in such a tiny fraction of the sky suggests that there are countless planets orbiting sun-like stars in our galaxy, said William Borucki of NASA's Ames Research Center in Moffett Field, California, the mission's science principal investigator. Now, we went from 0 to 68 Earth-sized planet candidates and 0 to 54 candidates in the habitable zone, some of which have moons with liquid water. Among the stars with planetary candidates, 170 show evidence of multiple planetary candidates. Kepler-11, located approximately 2,000 light-years from Earth, is the most tightly packed planetary system yet discovered. All six of its confirmed planets have orbits smaller than Venus, and five of the six orbits smaller than Mercury's. The only other star with more than one confirmed transiting planet is Kepler-9, which has three. The Kepler-11 findings will be published in the February 3rd issue of the journal Nature. And if you want to read more about this right now, you can go to nasa.gov. And you know, reports like this make us think, wonder what's going to happen in 100 years. Wonder what this means. What are the implications of our environment, Earth, all these reports we talk about constantly about our space travel? How about if we take a little trip and we listen to a story called The Mysterious Traveler. A young scientist takes a jaunt 100 years into the future to learn what's in store for his 20th century countrymen in an attempt to prevent future blight. And without further ado, The Mysterious Traveler.
The Mysterious Traveler, written, produced, and directed by Robert A. Arthur and David Kogan, and starring tonight two of radio's foremost actors, Leon Janney and Charlotte Holland, in Operation Tomorrow.
This is the Mysterious Traveler, inviting you to join me on another journey into the realm of the strange and the terrifying. I hope you will enjoy the trip. It will thrill you a little and chill you a little. So settle back, get a good grip on your nerves, and be comfortable, if you can, as we journey with a young scientist into the unknown future. It's a story I call Operation Tomorrow. My story begins in a scientific laboratory cut out of the solid rock many feet beneath New York City University. Amidst a maze of electronic apparatus, Professor Wilbur Malcolm, a middle-aged pipe-smoking man, is making methodical tests, aided by his new assistant, Fred Andrews.
The main output coils seem to be working the way they should. You ready at the meters, Fred?
Yes, Professor. But I wish I knew what we were doing.
You will in a few seconds, my boy. Now, wind up that alarm clock and put it here on this lead table in the center of the magnetic field.
This old alarm clock?
Yes.
There. All right, it's in the magnetic field. Now what?
Now I'm going to turn on the current. You give me the readings as we go along.
Right, sir.
Here we go. Readings, please.
1,000 volts positive main output tube. 1,500. 2,000. 3. 4. 5. 6. 7. 8,000. 9. 10,000.
All right. We've reached critical voltage. Now watch the clock closely, Fred.
The clock? Yes, sir. Why, it's getting a little hazy. Hard to see. Now it's transparent, as if it were made of glass. What is this, Professor?
Patience, my boy. Watch and observe. That's the scientist's motto.
Well, the tick is getting fainter. Fading out. The clock is disappearing. Professor, the clock has vanished.
So it has. Gone completely.
But where? Don't tell me you've discovered the secret of invisibility.
Well, something bigger than that, Fred. But watch now. I'm going to cut off the alpha tubes. Now I'll cut in the beta tubes. That will give us a negative charge and reverse the magnetic field. You ready, Fred?
Yes, sir.
Here we go. Readings, please.
2,000 volts negative. 3,000 negative. 4,000. 5. 6. 7. 8. 9. 10,000 volts negative.
Good. I'm holding the field at 10,000. Now watch where the clock was.
I'm watching, sir. Good Lord, I see a ghost of a clock there. Just a misty outline. Now it's becoming clearer and clearer. It's transparent. Now it's almost solid. Why, I can hear it ticking again.
And there it's back. Oh. Yes, Fred. The clock is back. And as you can hear, still in good working order.
But where was it? Where did it go?
Where did it go? It went into the future.
Into the future?
Yes, my boy. That clock has just penetrated approximately 1 year into the future. You've witnessed the first demonstration of something that up to now has always been considered a fantastic dream. Time travel.
Good Lord.
Ah, that's enough for today. You're coming home with me, Fred, while I tell you my plans.
How did you stumble onto this time travel effect, sir?
Well, it came about almost by sheer accident. My main purpose, which is a top secret operation, is to develop electronic controls for atomic spaceships.
You mean they've been developed?
Oh, no, not yet. But it shouldn't be long now. Science is making incredibly rapid advances. And sometimes it worries me. When you travel so fast, there's danger of a collision.
Yes, I know. We're all of us worried that the world is headed for a gigantic disaster, but there doesn't seem to be anything we can do about it.
Perhaps there is. That's what I've been working around to tell you, Fred.
What, Professor Malcolm?
Well, this time travel effect that I stumbled on accidentally. I've kept it a secret. You're the only person besides myself to know about it.
I'm very flattered, sir.
Well, I know I can trust you. And I need your help. I'm not sure we're really ready for time travel. As we were just saying, we're going so fast now, so many new discoveries that we don't know how to handle for the world's good. I hesitate to add one more to the list.
I think I understand.
But on the other hand, maybe it can be used for mankind's benefit. I have a wild scheme, Fred. Very unscientific, and yet...
What is it, Professor?
Well, it's this. I propose to send you in a little jaunt into the future.
Into the future?
Yes. I want you to bring back information. I want to find out what's in store for us mortals of the 20th century, Fred. If it's bad, war, perhaps... Just knowing about it in advance may make it possible to prevent it. Do you follow me?
Huh. It would be like knowing in advance about a train wreck and then seeing that it doesn't happen.
I knew you'd understand. That's why I sent for you. As soon as we've completed our tests, I propose to send you through time 100 years into the future.
For days and weeks, Fred Andrews and Professor Malcolm experimented. Until they were sure it would be possible to send a human being into the future and bring him back safely. At last, they were ready for the big test, for the actual transmission of Fred himself through time.
Professor, I'm all ready. Why are you hesitating?
Well, Fred, as we've been working, suspicion has been growing in my mind.
What suspicion, sir?
I don't think this is going to work.
But, Professor, we've sent dozens of objects into the future and brought them back. Even live animals. Cats, dogs.
Yes. But we've never brought back an object from the future itself. I mean, one we didn't send there.
No, that's true.
I wonder if... Well, no matter. We'll see. Now, remember, gather all the information you can and get back to this spot 6 hours from now. I'll activate the return field then and bring you back to 1950.
Yes, sir. I'll do my best.
I guess that's all. Good luck, my boy.
Thank you, sir.
5,000 volts positive. 6,000 volts. How do you feel?
I feel fine, Professor.
8,000 volts. 9. 10,000. Critical voltage. You're beginning to move forward into time. You're getting transparent now. Can you hear me?
Yes, Professor Malcolm. I can hear you, but you sound very far away. I can't see you any longer. I seem to be in the middle of a fog or mist. Now I'm just surrounded by blackness. I can't hear or see anything.
He's gone. Pray heaven he comes back safely.
For a long moment, Fred Andrews felt as if he was spinning dizzily through empty darkness. Then the feeling passed, and he cautiously opened his eyes to find himself standing in an empty room, the laboratory which he had just left 100 years ago. Unsteadily, he crossed the room and, with difficulty, opened the door. Then he gasped. Outside was a maze of corridors and stairways, brilliantly lighted as if a whole city had been carved out of the rock of Manhattan Island. As he stood there, someone came walking swiftly past him, an attractive girl in full military uniform.
I beg your pardon.
Yes?
But can you
What are you
tell
doing
me...
here? This section is forbidden to civilians.
Forbidden to civilians? I don't get it.
How did you get past the guards? Where are your identification papers?
No, wait a minute. Since when does an American citizen have to carry identification papers?
Ever since the war started, as you know quite well. Put up your hands.
A gun? No, look, miss, you don't have to threaten me. I'm harmless.
Stand still. I want to see if you're carrying a weapon.
Well, satisfied? The only weapon I have is a fountain pen.
What's your name?
Frederick Andrews, Ph.D.
Your draft card, please.
Draft card? Look, what's all this about? War, draft card, identification papers. All these tunnels that have been dug down here. I'm a stranger here.
I don't know what you're up to, but no one can be that ignorant. You're coming along with me to see Colonel Phillips.
Colonel Phillips?
He's the security officer for this sector. And I certainly hope you have a good story to tell him.
So your story, Mr. Andrews, is that you've come here from the year 1950. You must realize it's a very unconvincing tale.
Completely unconvincing, in my opinion, Colonel.
Well, it's the only story I have. I was born in 1923, and in 1950, Professor Wilbur Malcolm of City University sent me into the future. Now I'm here, and, I forgot to ask the date.
It's April 10th, 2050.
Exactly 100 years. Professor Malcolm's calculations were accurate to almost the minute.
Colonel, in my opinion, this man is a very clever spy.
Spy? But look at that stuff you took from my pockets. The notebook, fountain pen, my driver's license, dated 1950. Those coins and bills, the cigarettes. Surely they convince you I came from 100 years ago.
I think we can settle the question, Mr. Andrews. Our technical department can tell whether this currency is genuine and approximately how old it is. Lieutenant French.
Yes, sir.
Send all these things by pneumatic tube to the technical department. Ask them for an immediate report.
I'll have a report for you in half an hour.
When the report comes, Mr. Andrews, I'll know how to handle your case. If you are a spy, you know the penalty.
Well, I'm not worried, Colonel. Now, may I ask a few questions? Are you at war?
We are indeed at war.
And these miles of tunnels I saw, carved out of the solid rock.
This city has retreated underground, Mr. Andrews. No one lives on the surface now.
Good Lord. How long has the war been going on?
We've been at war, Mr. Andrews. Off and on, of course, with periods in between in which both sides have rested up for 95 years.
Well, a visitor at last. Hello, Lieutenant French.
I'm sorry, Mr. Andrews, that we had to keep you locked up until you were cleared.
Does that mean you believe my story now?
Technical division says your story is true.
I'm free now?
Well, not exactly, Mr. Andrews. This is a military sector, and you're a civilian. But I am to be your guide for the time being.
Good. Then, suppose I call you Emily, and you call me Fred.
All right, Fred.
There's a great deal I want to see and learn before I go back to 1950.
Go back? You mean you can return?
Of course. Professor Malcolm will turn on his gadgets to bring me back at 4 o'clock.
That's only 3 hours. I'll have to report this to Colonel Phillips. After I've reported, what would you like to do?
I'm anxious to see what's going on. And I'd like to collect a number of books with the latest scientific and historical data to take back with me.
Yes, all right. I'll phone the Colonel. Then I'll show you around. Fred, here's the plotting room for the flying bomb attack.
Good Lord, it's as big as a theater. And it's dark. What's that big board with lights on it?
That's the chart board which records every flying bomb within 1,000 miles of American territory.
Self-guided missile entering detection net over Greenland. General course south, southwest.
I have it plotted. Send up interceptor rockets when it reaches zone 4.
Yes, sir. Rockets 34 and 35 successfully intercepted at defense zone 4.
Now you see, Fred, two lights just went out. That means we sent up destroyer rockets, which brought the bomb down.
Rocket bombs 29 and 31 have eluded interception at zone 3.
Interception salvo at zone 2. If they penetrate, use interceptor L-100 at zone 1.
L-100 is our new top-secret interceptor, Fred. Hardly anyone knows how it works, but it never fails.
Four more lights went out then.
Mm-hmm, and here comes the report.
Last four rockets successfully intercepted.
Roger.
Well, Fred, what do you think of modern
rocket
warfare?
Rocket 25 has penetrated zone 2.
It's horrifying.
Interceptor
and
L-100 is being launched now.
Seems to take it so calmly.
You can't get excited when a thing has lasted for almost 100 years on and off.
That light,
number
25, it's still on and moving.
But it should have been destroyed by now. Do you suppose...
Rocket number 25 has eluded interceptor attack by L-100.
It has, but it can't have.
Report on 25, please.
Detection base 103 reports number 25, apparently new type rocket, non-metallic construction, able to baffle sighting mechanism of L-100.
Order technical crew to search for fragments after the hit. Send general warning to eastern seaboard area. Give plotted strike prediction.
Very good, sir. All personnel in Eastern District, all personnel, bomb strike due in 10 seconds. Battery area, bomb strike due in 5 seconds, 4 seconds, bomb strike due in 3 seconds, 2 seconds, 1 second. All personnel, bomb strike over.
All right, Fred. I'll take you to the viewing room next. You can see for yourself what this city looks like in the year 2050. Lieutenant French reporting back with Mr. Andrews, sir.
Very good, Lieutenant. Well, Mr. Andrews, have a good look around.
Yes, sir. I saw the city through the television viewing screens.
Not quite the city you left, is it?
It's unbelievable. Just acres of twisted steel and fallen stone. The skeletons of giant buildings lying across one another, rusting. It's like the end of the world.
Not quite. Perhaps not even the end of civilization. Man is an adaptable creature.
But are we winning, sir?
Nobody wins a war anymore, Mr. Andrews. We're holding our own, and we hope when the end comes, there will be peace on Earth forever.
But how did it start, sir? We were trying so hard to prevent war back in 1950. In fact, one reason for my trip into time was to get information that might help us keep war from breaking out.
Lieutenant French, why didn't we think of that?
Think of what, sir?
If the world of 1950 knows the truth, maybe it won't happen. Either they can prevent the accident that started all this back in 1955, or at least they'll know the truth when it does happen.
Of course, sir. Mr. Andrews can take the true story back with him.
What story? I don't follow you.
Fred, you asked how the war started.
Yes.
It started because of an accident. and an over-jittery world.
Yes, my boy, a horrible irony.
Fred, now listen. During the 1950s, the government established a special experimental base in the heart of the Arizona desert, in a little town called Red Rock.
Red Rock, Arizona?
Yes, that's right. The first space rocket was put into production there, and work was pushed on the problem of fuel.
During the course of experiments, an explosion occurred, late in 1955.
It was a terrific blast, wiped out the whole base. The first reports were sabotage, that the enemy had blown up the base because they were afraid we were on the verge of getting space flight.
Before the truth became known, our newspaper screamed for retaliation. The enemy became panicky and decided to strike first. And phase one of the war was on. When we discovered the blast was really an accident, it was too late to stop.
That's horrible, sir. War, because everybody was just too jittery.
But it doesn't have to be. Don't you see, if you take back the true story before it happens, it won't have to happen. Now look, I've assembled a dozen books for you. The information in them will enable your scientists to prevent that blast at Red Rock Base.
Now, Fred, you've got to get the facts back to them. You've just got to.
I will. Believe me, Professor Malcolm and I will see to it this war doesn't start in our time.
Good. Now come along. You've only 5 minutes more.
This is the exact spot where I was lying when I came through the time dimension, Colonel Phillips.
You've only 30 seconds more, Andrews. Remember, impress the lesson of the accident at Red Rock on the world. These books, hold them close to you so they'll go back with you.
Yes, sir. I've got a good grip on them.
Fred.
Yes, Emily?
Just good luck.
Thanks. Maybe I'll pay another trip to 2050.
I hope so.
It's 1600. And Professor Malcolm is on time...
Look, Colonel. He's getting transparent. He's disappearing.
Goodbye, Emily. I guess this is it. Hope to see you again sometime.
But, sir, the books, they aren't disappearing. They're just as solid as ever. Fred! Fred!
What? I can hardly hear you. Everything's gray and misty. Are you still there? Emily... Are you still there?
The books, Fred!
Andrews, you're going back with the books! They're staying here!
He's appearing. He's returning. Thank heaven he's safe. Fred, my boy. Fred, what's the matter? You're staring at me as if you didn't know me. Here, Fred, let me help you up. It's I, Professor Malcolm.
Professor Malcolm.
Yes. Don't tell me you don't remember.
Professor Malcolm?
Yes, Fred. What's the matter?
Oh, my head feels so funny. I can't seem to remember who you are or what's happened to me. What am I doing here?
Well, Fred, how are you?
Oh, Professor Malcolm, it's good to see you, sir.
I can't tell you how I've been blaming myself ever since the experiment.
Oh, nonsense. I haven't suffered any harm. Just a blank place in my mind. I can't understand it. Do you suppose the experiment failed?
You were gone for 6 hours. Somewhere. That's all I know, Fred. If you did get to 2050, Fred...
Yes, sir?
Well, I have a theory that though we can move from past to future... It's impossible for anything belonging in the future to move to the past. The structure of time itself prevents that.
I see.
So, if you did try to bring back any books or papers, they stayed behind.
You must be right.
You can't remember because nothing that you didn't take with you could come back with you, even including sensory impressions on your brain cells. The very act of returning wiped out your memories.
Maybe if I went again... We could find some way around the problem. There must be some way, sir.
No, Fred. I'm dropping the whole subject for the time being. I've been transferred to a new assignment, and you're coming with me.
Well, what is the assignment, sir?
All spaceship research is being concentrated at a new base now being developed. You and I are going out there to help develop a fuel that will take a rocket to the moon.
I see. Where is the base, Professor Malcolm?
Oh, someplace in the west. I believe they call it Red Rock. Arizona.
Red Rock? The name seems awfully familiar to me. I wonder why.
Colonel,
mysterious traveler. Well, time travel doesn't seem to be all it's been painted. Especially if you can't remember what's happened when you get back. You aren't worried about the future, are you? You know that tonight's story couldn't possibly happen. Or could it? Oh, you have to get off now. I'm sorry. But I'm sure we'll meet again. I take this same train every week at this same time.
Well, if he can't remember his travels, maybe he should go to sleep. According to our research, he might be able to remember it after all. Well, that about wraps it up for Savage Science this week. You have a lovely Valentine's Day, and keep your powder in your pants dry. Happy trails until next we meet again.
Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name? Hello, I love you, let me jump in your game. Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name? Hello, I love you, let me jump in your game. She's walking down the street, blind to every eye she meets. Do you think you'll be the guy to make the queen of the angels sigh? Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name? Hello, I love you, let me jump in your game. Hello, I love you, won't you tell me your name? Hello, I love you, let me jump in your game. She holds her head so high, like a statue in the sky. Her arms are wicked and her legs are long. When she moves, my brain screams out this song.